Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right?
Tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Three of my friends murdered by cops, shot in the back, shot when they didn't have a gun or a knife, claiming the suspect had a shiny object. You know, cops like killing. That's why they're cops. Yeah. Who's gonna be next, huh?
Cops like you to be scared of them. That's what makes them men. Real men. Because without the uniform, what are they? I'm not scared.
They respected cops in my day, otherwise they hit you in the head with a billy. They didn't take no gun. No, they were the law. Nowadays, I guess, they gotta shoot you to get respect.
Nobody gives no crap to the cops no more since this crazy cop come along. You see a cop coming now, you get out of the way. And there ain't much crime no more.
From our Dad Chester on our headquarters, here's Bill Lustig's Maniac Cop from 1988. Interesting conceit to have a killer cop, which is pretty amazing as an idea when you think about it, because no one would suspect a thing, and there's many, many ways to cover your tracks as a killer. Now, does Maniac Cop deliver on the scares that are inherent in having a member of the Thin Blue Line committing all these murders? I would say no, but you got to hand it to them for making kind of a fun, unique, interesting movie with a lot of flaws. So, Maniac Cop, what's your take?
Well, before we get into my take, I mean, I guess we should just address the elephant in the room. Nowadays, killer cops is all the rage. I mean,
yeah.
Not all the rage, but it's that's
yeah,
that's
yeah, not, bad pun. But yeah, like police brutality, yeah, and going back to the L.A. Rodney King beating and everything, there is something inherently scary, and everyone in
of
our audience.
Blue Lives Matter versus
yeah.
All Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, et cetera, et cetera.
Everyone's had a run-in. Well, not everyone. Maybe I'm speaking a little too broadly. But
everyone
okay.
in this room, let's say.
Everyone in this room has had run-ins with law enforcement, whether it be on a really minor level as a being pulled over and, let's say, ride program or one of these things, or just underage drinking, what have you. Like it's an intimidating experience as it's going through customs. Anytime you deal with someone who could put you away, there's something about that is ripe for exploitation and horror.
Well, I mean, there's something inherently dichotomous about a policeman, because on the one hand, I mean, here in Toronto, their motto is to protect and serve. So on the one hand, they're the ones we look at to keep us safe. And they're the ones who are protecting us. On the other hand, they are figures of intimidation. You know, every time I see a cop, and this stems back from when I was a young kid, through my teenage years, when I probably really had a reason to be afraid for seeing a cop, to today, I can't help but feel just a little bit intimidated because, A, they're packing.
For sure.
You know, and even if it's, I mean, in North America, of course, they're packing lethal weapons, like guns, and even if it's in London, England, I mean, okay, they're not armed, but they're still, they have weapons, and whether it's a baton or what have you, and B, they have the authority, and it's based on their whim and their discretion.
This is true.
That if they want to pull you over, or they want to question you, and if you say the wrong thing, or do the wrong thing, or happen to have the wrong thing in your pocket, you could be thrown in prison. Now, I have been thrown in prison. I was actually arrested when I was in my early 20s, and I spent a night in prison, and it was not a fun experience. And all I could say is that the cops who arrested me
would this be in Mexico by any chance?
No.
Oh, okay. That's almost like a rite of passage when you go to Mexico to get thrown in jail for a night. Okay. Oh, that's surprising. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the cops that arrested me were not. They weren't protecting me. They weren't serving me. They weren't upholding my rights in any way. In many ways, they were fucking with me. You know, like I was scared. I was arrested for assault, and from it was self defense, but I was the aggressor. From being the aggressor in this fight, all of a sudden I'm in the back of a police car.
So which jail was this? Like Metro East or something? Like is Toronto?
Well, it was some holding cell in Richmond Hill.
Oh, okay.
But then I got transferred to a courthouse in a paddy wagon, handcuffed about five other people, and this happened on a Saturday night going into Sunday.
Yeah.
So I was basically in a paddy wagon with five people that were there for beating their wives or girlfriends.
Jesus.
In a stupor. It was
just thank God it wasn't the Don Jail. Like in the 19th century, just a hellhole with rats in downtown Toronto that everyone is just terrified
but,
of.
But, I mean, you know.
Still, so, yeah, there's no good jail.
When I was in that holding cell, I was in a cell all to myself. They fucked with me. It was freezing cold.
Yeah.
I didn't have a pillow. I didn't have a blanket. The only thing they gave me to eat was one little McDonald's hamburger. Mm. Not a Big Mac. Not a quarter pounder cheese. Just one hamburger. And then, when I was taken to the courthouse in the paddy wagon, I was in a cell with six other people, or five other people. I don't know if we're called the number. And I had to relieve myself.
Yeah.
And...
yeah, in front of everyone else.
You
that's
got
to be fun right there.
It
yeah.
was, and there was some toilet paper. So, I mean, this was a humiliating experience.
As long as it wasn't number two.
Who said it wasn't?
Oh, no. That just makes it San Quentin now. With the number two? Oh, my God.
And then
nobody deserves that. That's cruel, unusual punishment.
And it's so funny because this is something I don't tell very many people.
Mm.
And... I was even afraid to tell my wife this story. And I'm not going into all the gory details right now. And now I'm letting it, go out over the area of yeah. cyberspace. But
we were only downloaded in 50 countries and counting. That's all right.
Then when I was finally, when I taken to see the judge to see if they would grant me bail, and walking out there and standing there handcuffed and looking out into the
gallery,
yeah. and seeing my entire family look at me with just. Shameful look in their eye. It was just humiliating left, right, and center. So my prison experience lasted for about 24 hours. When I was let out, and that's another thing too, in the paddy wagon, because all you want to do when you're in prison is you want to see sunshine. And you're in this holding cell, and you don't see any sunshine. You don't know if it's night.
Jeez, it's not like the Birdman of Alcatraz. You were there one night.
I know, but this is so dramatic. I'm going through with you.
Oh my God, I have rickets. Vitamin D.
They put you into the paddy wagon. It's in a garage that's closed. And when you're in the paddy wagon, we're locked up in the back. There's no windows. So you don't see any sunshine. When I was finally released after 24 hours, I got to tell you, dude, it was like the Shawshank Redemption. I was institutionalized. I didn't know how to. Society had changed so much.
Yeah.
What was these newfangled gadgets? Automobile? No, I'm just kidding. It was bad. But like, I mean, this is a sort of a long digression. But
well, yeah, it's people who are entrusted to look out for your well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And people you don't normally associate, well, maybe now so you do, but with horrifying things. And this was written by Larry Cohen, who knows a thing or two about scaring you with things that shouldn't scare you, i.e. babies. And we're going to podcast It's Alive one of these days.
Of course.
Promise,
and
we're big fans of Larry Cohen.
The stuff,
an
innocuous dessert item became...
And versatile guy, too, who did, Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem. Like, the guy
Hugh
did...
The Wing is Serpent, God Told Me To. The man is...
He's incredible.
He is incredible. And William Lustig is incredible. His filmography is not... the most prolific, let's say, his directorial photography. He's done a lot of stuff for special features on DVDs and Blu-rays, whether it was Anchor Bay, moving on to his own company, Blue Underground, produced many, many featurettes. But as far as being a director, he only directed a handful of movies, but one of them being one of our all-time favorite movies, which I think is almost a travesty that we've yet to podcast it, Maniac.
Yeah, and knock on wood, we'll be able to talk to Bill Lustig in Toronto.
Oh, we will be, because he's going to be at Horrorama mid-October. We'll be there, and he'll be there. So, hopefully we'll see you guys there, too.
Yeah, for sure.
We're looking forward to sitting down and chatting with Bill Lustig.
And it's interesting when you compare Maniac versus Maniac Cop. They're such different killers. The one guy, Maniac Cop, is really an unstoppable killing machine that we've come to associate with Jason Voorhees. And Joe Spinell's character in Maniac is almost ineffectual. He's just such a banal everyman that you don't get the impression that he's as ruthless as he is. He could be your neighbor. And so they're really different and yet similar, because they're both obviously set in New York City, although mm-hmm. to varying degrees in Maniac Cop. We'll get to that soon. Exposing the seedy underbelly of a grim urban milieu and using that for fear. So that's what he brings to the table here.
And also the other thing too is that in Maniac Cop, there's a bit of a supernatural element involved. You know, we have this zombie-like killer cop, whereas Maniac is as grounded as...
In realism as you can possibly get.
Right. So, I mean, and really, I mean, the only similarity they have is the word maniac in the title.
Yeah.
They're really two very different films. I mean, they're both in New York, sure, but, I mean, they're very different movies. Of course, Maniac is the much more successful of the two, and one of these days we will podcast Maniac. And we'll
one of the greatest, like,
rhapsodize over that movie.
Oh, yeah. In our top five, one of the greatest horror films of all time.
But Maniac Cop. So, getting back to what I was saying earlier before I went on that long digression about my checkered criminal past. Yeah, it's very dichotomous. You know, we look to police to protect us. Should we need to be protected? If we're in danger? If we're a victim? But in many ways, they can victimize us. And this movie alludes to that. I wouldn't say exploits it, but alludes to that. And that's Larry Cohen. He alludes to things. He doesn't hit over the head with a hammer when it comes to the messages, but he infers and brings up.
And
so
you get this right out of the gate with, let's say, two members of the underclass, which would be two sort of two-bit Puerto Rican gangsters who are chasing a server outside of her bar after hours, after closing. And you get the setup of a typical nightmarish urban mugging, where this woman is attacked for her purse, and you think the film is going to go one way. She escapes. Her attempted assailants chase her through the park, and this is taking place, I think, in the East Village or Greenwich. She eludes them, only to find this police officer. She's grateful for seeing this guy in the distance, and he's this white-gloved figure, tall, like 6'2", 6'3", rushes up to him, and he just proceeds to throttle her right in front of these two hoods. Now, the two hoodlums come into prominence later because they're trying to plead their case, saying, listen, she ran to a cop, the cop killed her, and the cop's investigating and saying, yeah, sure, these two Puerto Rican goons. We're supposed to believe these two idiots, and they don't whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So nothing happens, and the guy's left to continue killing.
Although there is one cop that does believe her, and that is Lieutenant Frank McRae, played by the incredible genre vet Tom Atkins. We got just a little note about the cast of this movie. We got Tom Atkins. We got Bruce Campbell. I'm going to talk a bit more about Bruce Campbell later on in this and his portrayal in this movie. We have the wonderful Robert Zadar, and I'm going to talk more about Robert Zadar later. And then we've got Laureen Landon, who's sort of a B-movie actress. I mean, she was in a canon movie called America 3000. She was in a movie called Hundra, Yellow Hair, and something else. It was some female Indiana Jones ripoff. And she was in Samurai Cop 2. And she had a cameo appearance in one of your favorite films of recent vintage, Hunter.
Yes, fantastic.
So, great cast. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Oh, and I didn't... How can I forget? I would be totally
remiss. Sam Raimi,
Well, I was going to say Sam Raimi has a cameo. Mm. Richard Roundtree.
Oh, yes. Shaft himself. Mm-hmm. When you look into, obviously, Larry Cohen's blaxploitation pedigree, you would have thought some of the other, you know, principles of that genre. But I guess he'd never really worked with him, and Shaft himself as the commissioner.
Commissioner Pike. So,
yeah, really cool character.
So McRae, this would be the Atkins character.
Yeah, lieutenant.
He has his suspicions that it actually was copied. Frank McRae actually, because when he saw
the ligature marks on mm-hmm. the neck or whatever it is, the strangulation marks,
yeah.
it could not have been made by two small teenage
gangsters. He actually starts to suspect that this is a cop, and he starts making some, perhaps, you know, somebody's gone rogue, and he's making noise within the department that there could be a killer cop out there. He's taken into Commissioner Pike's office, and he's...
This is great, yeah. He gives a speech where he says the killer is a cop who's under duress, under stress, and maybe not thrilled with his job. And then Commissioner Pike says, oh, why don't we test the whole department? So that was a pretty funny line.
And then he starts questioning his, McCrae's sanity.
Yeah, and then McCrae was involved in a attempted suicide that mm-hmm. went south, lucky for him. And then he starts to say, yeah, maybe you're a little understressed yourself there, buddy.
But he sort of reads in the Riot Act, because for two reasons. Number one, if it is a cop who's out there killing other innocent people, obviously IA has to get involved in criminal affairs. Number two, he doesn't want the public, the media, getting wind of this, because he doesn't want the public to be distrustful of cops.
Mm-hmm.
Now, McCrae feels the opposite. He goes, you know, everybody is uber trustful of cops. We need to let them know that there's a killer cop out there so that they have their guards up.
Yeah, proper precautions, and maybe ask for a badge number or do whatever it is you're supposed to do. They don't really explore that too much, but...
So what McCrae ends up doing is he sort of goes into business for himself, and he tips off a journalist that these murders, because now it's becoming murders, plural, could very well be committed by a member of the Thin Blue Line, is that what they're called?
Yeah, yeah.
By a member of the Thin Blue Line. And this has a very unexpected consequence, whereas citizens are now completely afraid of cops, distrustful of cops, and there's this wonderful scene where this woman's car breaks down, and, poor cliche, she can't get started, policeman comes up behind her, we're led to believe that this is our maniac cop, she pulls out a gun, blows him away, he's just some young rookie cop, etc.
Yeah, and we have a red herring in here who's the character played by Bruce Campbell, who's Jack Forrest, and the murders are pinned on him because this police officer is leading a bit of a troubled existence here.
Well,
he's having an affair, yeah.
With Lori Landon's character.
Yeah, he's taking her off to these seedy motels and getting into these arguments with his wife.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, he's having trouble with his wife. They're going through therapy. He's having an affair with Teresa Mallory, which is Lorraine Lennon's character. He's going out one night, ostensibly on the beat. His wife follows him into some sleazy motel. I think it was called Budget Inn or something.
And she's packing like a little gun, like a little 22.
What is doing in the heart of New York City? Because motels are usually like, you know,
we'll get to that later on.
Yeah. She's packing a gun. She's crazy. He manages to escape unscathed, but then she's snatched by the maniac cop and strangled and killed. So when her body is found, they
surmise it's him because he's the last person to see her alive. But they're married, and anytime you have spousal acrimony, it's usually the husband who's the perp in this case. So it's pretty obvious police work who you're going to drag in and imprison. Mm-hmm. So
and to compound poor Jack's problems, his wife was convinced that he was the maniac cop.
Yeah, and she had it in her diary. Like, why does this guy keep going out at night?
Exactly.
Yeah, like,
So
he's working a lot of night shifts.
So he's arrested. He's interrogated not only by Pike, but by this hard-ass cop, Riley, who's a pretty interesting character. He's one of these guys always wearing sunglasses.
Yeah.
But the reality is that Jack is not our maniac cop. And then it becomes a bit of a procedural with McCrae trying to piece together clues as to who this maniac cop is, why is he doing what he's doing, and it's interesting. It works to a certain degree. I really like the character of maniac cop. Gigantic, hulking, mute, almost like a uniform version of Michael Myers or something. But I'm not a big fan of his origin, how he became to be who he was.
Yeah, that was pretty hackneyed.
Yeah.
That was pretty weak.
Basically, he was decorated officer Matt Cordell. And Cordell was one of these, you know, shoot first, ask questions later cops. And ultimately, it was some political machinations or what have you, he was arrested for trampling on citizens' rights thrown into Sing Sing, where he was then basically
beaten down I mean, the least popular person in prison would be if you're a cop, so
so he was killed. He was killed in the shower. He took out a few, but he
that was a great scene.
Yeah,
it was really intense, an amazing shower beatdown where he's just lathering up and then these three thugs jump him. And
watching Robert Zadar lather up is always intense.
Yeah, indeed. And he shakes one of them off his back, beats down a couple, but they're too much for him, and they shank him.
The scene was wonderfully shot. Mm-hmm. However, the soundtrack, this was a lengthy flashback, was one of the most annoying pieces of music I've heard in movies in quite a while, but anyway.
And we should also say, like, on the subject of, well, this film's debits here, where while it is a great character, not even monosyllabic, he's zero syllabic, he doesn't say anything. He's just out there on the street exploiting the public. But when they start to pursue him, there are supernatural elements that I felt really were detractors mm-hmm. for me here, and they peppered him full of bullets like he was, again, Jason Voorhees, and it was really, really unnecessary. They could have crafted something far more sinister and dangerous if he'd just been someone like us, and that, I think, speaks to his physical appearance as well, mm-hmm. which is a little bit of a tell, to use a poker term. I didn't think that was necessarily, although I like Robert Zadar, obviously Samurai Cop.
I love Robert Zadar.
But having him as like a sinister looking guy that you know is evil.
We really don't see his face until for much of the movie.
True, but you see the jaw. You see
a
presence.
He's a big man. Yeah. You see a presence. The movie sort of devolves in the third act. Once they figure out that it is Matt Cordell reanimated in some weird fashion, out there killing, no longer killing the guilty, now killing the innocent as well, and then trying to hunt them down. It becomes sort of a standard movie. And another thing that was quite shocking is that about two-thirds of the way through, Atkins is taken out in a sort of a very mundane way. I mean, he received top billing in the credits, but he's killed off two-thirds of the way through, and he was thrown into some lockers, and that was the end of that. It was a very anticlimactic death scene for Atkins. And then the rest of the movie is Jack trying to clear his name.
Yeah, he's the fall guy, as they say, actually, in the movie, and he's teaming up
with Teresa, and they're trying to bring down Maniac Cop. Now, you mentioned at the beginning of this discussion that it didn't really bring the frights.
It was almost had a madcap vaudevillian feel to it in a way that it wasn't. The kills were rather unremarkable. They weren't going for the gusto in terms of gore or like with the infamous Tom Savini scalping of Maniac. This was almost, the first kill was almost a throwaway. Mm-hmm. He just grabs a woman by the neck, throws her down. It really wasn't.
But it's interesting because again, Maniac Cop, Robert Zadar, he's such a looming, imposing physical presence. And, it's funny because when you look at, like, the Friday movies, as the character of Jason evolved, obviously in part two, he wasn't as physically imposing as he became in, let's say, part six.
Yeah, he was a teenager.
But
give him a break.
He's a big guy, and yet he's saying all these elaborate death traps. Like, why do you need that?
Yeah.
Really, this is a gigantic man, I don't know, 6 foot.
Yeah,
seven,
whatever, yeah.
Huge hands, enough to throttle a woman, kill them. He did have a bayonet sort of thing, a sword. Yeah. Didn't really use him much, but we didn't really need to have remarkable kills. I think just the physical presence alone was enough to...
Well, the one evocative scene was when the boyfriend and his paramour get pulled over for a spot check, and he steps out of the vehicle, and... he beats him down right in front of the girlfriend with a baton, and that was pretty sinister because she's watching helplessly from the vehicle and can't do anything. So there were a few evocative moments, but not really. And I guess they had some trouble also filming in New York City because at the beginning you see the Bleecker Street Cinema, which is, I think, on 11th Avenue somewhere in Greenwich Village. You get this neat look at the village bar scene in New York City, and then you can tell immediately that this was filmed elsewhere because, again, that motel, there's no sleazebag no-tell motel in downtown Manhattan.
You've never seen that in downtown Manhattan.
Yeah, yeah. And then they clearly going out, as I think this was filmed in Culver City, where I think one of your neighbors actually is from. But yeah, I was looking at it and I did see palm trees a la Halloween in Illinois, and I thought, oh my God, this scenescape is not New York anymore. And it took me a little out of it because I was so into the village bar scene, because, you know, we love New York. It's like, this is a New York movie. And then as soon as they left, I left as well, in a way.
Were you literally into the village bar scene?
No, not literally, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because, maybe something about you, I don't know.
Yeah. No. We podcast the Village People movie, but we know New York well. And
we like these villages. I mean, there's a bar we both really like a lot in these villages.
Doc Holliday's on Avenue A, shout out. But yeah, this was really an intense...
I love Bleecker Street too, so...
Yeah, and it took too many roads away from this, it could have been.
The reality is they had permits to shoot in New York, but only for 3 days. So they did pickups to make it feel like it was in New York. They did the skyline. They did the aerial shots. You guess how this is going to take.
Yeah, and Sing Sing Prison was just up on Hudson River too. So,
But yeah, you could certainly. I didn't notice the palm trees myself, but yeah, you could tell that this was not fully lensed in New York, so it didn't have that real sort of urban decay feel that you got in Maniac, where the city itself is a character.
Yeah, for sure.
I do want to talk about another debit, and that being Bruce Campbell. He just wasn't Bruce Campbell in this movie. Do you know what I mean? Didn't you not find his performance to be a little bit almost sedate?
Yeah, he wasn't particularly well developed. He didn't get... Well, I guess he's the subject of... a backstory of a marriage being on the rocks. So all you get from him is a bunch of scowling and acrimony and issues with the missus. But that's really it. Like, you don't really get why he would be appealing to the woman he's having an affair with. It's a very straight arrow, straight edge performance. You don't get a sense of who he is or why he's doing what he's doing.
As a huge fan of BC, as Bruce Campbell, as somebody who pretty much worships at his altar. I've read all his books, of course, seen all his movies, I've met the man.
Oh,
I mean,
is the musical fantastic?
Yeah,
which
we've
seen
multiple times. I'm not expecting him to be Ashley Williams. I'm not expecting him to be saying Groovy Baby or all these one-liners.
Yeah.
I'm not expecting him to be as fucking badass as he is on Ash vs. Evil Dead on TV right now. But there's a certain charisma that Bruce Campbell always has. That in this film he just doesn't have. His character is almost a cipher, sort of milquetoast. And so that was surprising, because, I mean, for Bruce Campbell fans that watch Maniac Cop, they're going to be disappointed. He was not the main... We really don't even see him until about a third of the way through.
True.
And
we don't... Yeah, as I said, we don't get a sense of how he's so charismatic that he's able to be such a...
A cult figure, a worship figure.
Yeah, and how he's so successful with the ladies, and we don't get a sense
of... Oh, so you're talking about the character or not.
His association is with the police. Like, we don't get the sense, like, that he's really invested in his job, or that he's a third-generation cop, or that he loves serving the public good, or, like, we don't know why he is so sought after as... Like, oh, sure, he's a good-looking, tall guy, but he's got this affair going, and he's got this wife, but they're not... We don't know anything about why he's appealing or why his marriage is disintegrating, really. We don't learn anything about him. He's introduced to us late, and we get a scant snapshot version of him. And
now...
He's supposed to be the main character, really.
Right, yeah. We're sort of invested in two characters, Atkins and Campbell, and once Atkins is offed, then it's Campbell. Interestingly enough, both Bruce Campbell and Robert Zadar have been referred to as the chin. They're both famous for their chin. Bruce Campbell's first book, his autobiography, was called, I believe it was called If Chins Could Talk, or that could have been Jay Leno's biography.
Yeah.
But I do have it, I've read it, it's great. And of course, Robert Zadar, the man's chin is, it enters the room before him, right?
Yeah.
Now, I'm being a little facetious when I say that, because there's something about Robert Zadar that I adore. I don't know what it is. I have this thing about outsiders. I just really root for outsiders. And I think that Robert Zadar was almost like the ultimate outsider actor because of his physiognomy, because of the way he looked, right? With his rather large, this head large and,
yeah,
and as
presence.
As he grew old, I mean, he was wonderful in the fact that he could play a perfect villain, perfect heavy, because he was gigantic. So I have to backtrack now. I mean, this is a man that, like, as his life, as he's late now, this is a man...
Yeah, we're speaking about him in the past tense,
as his life was winding down, he became a meme, you know? People were saying, oh, this man's face looks like a catch was met, what have you. And as he got older, he got sicker, and he got more frail, and his face looked really, really big. And I mean, the fact of the matter is that because of his physiognomy, he was typecast. And the man made over 100 movies, but a lot of these movies are pure dreck. And he only made two or three, I would say, mainstream movies, one being Tango and Cash, and the other one being this. And this was, like, I would say, semi-mainstream. And most of the time, he's known for, like, really shit movies, like, but shit to the general populace, but movies I adore, like Soul Taker, Samurai Cop,
Hellhole.
That was his first movie. Run Like Hell, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And by all accounts, I never met the man. He was at the very first Shock Stock, I believe, maybe the first or second. And by all accounts, he was one of the nicest men out there, and one of the nicest people out there. But he just, I think, was a lot of times an object of scorn and ridicule because of the way he looked. Because he had, you know, his face was somewhat different. In many ways, Rondo Hatton was a horror actor way back when, who had some sort of physical deformity, and he used that to his advantage, and got roles in horror movies because of that. But Rondo Hatton had a much more illustrious career. I mean, to this day, they have horror awards they give out called, I believe, the Rondo Awards. They're not giving out the Zadar Awards. When Zadar passed away, my heart broke. So it's mostly because I really do root for The Outsider. So it's wonderful seeing Robert Zadar in, I think, the role that he's probably most famous for. Getting back to Maniac Cop, it's a fun movie. It's got a great conceit. You know, it's got Larry Cohen's smart script, which does allude to greater issues, but it does sort of devolve in the third act into your standard chase film with some kind of tacked on
ludicrous
supernatural elements. I did like the demise of Maniac Cop. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
But then we had, you know, the Deriger, oh, he's still alive at the end.
Yeah.
Not a spoiler, because they made two sequels, Maniac 2 and 3, Maniac Cop 2 and 3, none of which I've seen, but I think I will see them. I am interested to see how the story of Officer Matt Cordell continues.
Yeah, I agree, and the silly conceit also of the man who's wrongfully imprisoned having to break free and solve the crime before authorities get wind of his involvement. So you have Jack Forrest taking on the identity of a deceased McRae, running into the prison and trying to convince the coroner that something has gone wrong, and, like, really, this is not me who did this, this is someone else who's done it, and he's in cahoots with or working with the Vice Squad cop who's worked with the deceased McRae, and it's just all of his machinations toward the end. It was incredibly silly and a wasted opportunity.
Now, you're the one that always brings this up every time we talk about a horror movie. I'm going to bring it up now. This is a movie that would be excellent fodder for a remake. This is ripe for a remake in today's society that's so politically charged with, you know, cops and the liberties that some people say they take with their use of excessive force and so on.
Definitely.
Yeah, so, but at the same time, it still works in the time period it did, in the late 80s.
Yeah, because it's a timeless theme.
Yeah, and also because New York City was a pretty crime-al city still in the late 80s. So there's a lot of good to Maniac Cop. It's not a wholly perfect movie, but it's a movie I can easily recommend. And I would give this one 3 stars. Maybe it's a little stingy. Let's say 3 and... I don't want to do 3.5. Let's say 3.25.
Okay, let's 3. Yeah, I'm going to give it 3. It's a famous Alfred Hitchcock quote that says, it's not that I don't like the police, it's just that I'm afraid of them. So yeah, people have a natural fear of authority figures like this. It's great to tap into this fear, not done with the gusto I would have done it with. And if they had remade this, I would have made an everyman character be the star someone you don't suspect, some, I guess, kind of real everyman who could be your next-door neighbor, like the St. Louis shooter. Yes. Someone who could have been your next-door neighbor, just a real middle-of-the-road figure, which I think lends itself to greater horror than someone who ultimately looks horrifying, no disrespect to the late Robert Zadar. But when you talk about Joe Spinell in Maniac, like, he may have looked... He didn't look like a psycho in that film. He looked like a schlubbo loser. And a guy, a sad sack, who just has a blue-collar job.
Sweaty, swarthy.
Yeah, and he's perfect for the Hannah Arendt banality of evil character. He's your next-door neighbor. Guy. Just any guy. He could be anybody. And if I were to remake this, I'd make it with that. I'd set it in New York City and then really infuse it with some of the current issues that are really... affecting the Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter schism and movement today. So that's the way I would do it. And definitely leave aside the supernatural element. This whole Sing Sing prison bit was really beyond the pale ludicrous. I think it would actually be better if he had kids, too. Make the officer a family man. Give the guy a stable relationship with a wife, two kids, and he does this on the side. That would be fantastic.
They say, he didn't even have any wife and kids. Oh, he has a relationship. That's another little subplot we're not going to really delve into, but you're right. See, in many ways, I mean, he's unstoppable. Not only, I mean, I made the analogy of Michael Myers, he's also RoboCop-like.
Yeah.
You know? And when you think about RoboCop, Officer Murphy, you know, he had a wife and kids. So
this
that would
true,
be interesting. If you're right, I didn't think about that. If he had an actual family, Officer Cordell, and they knew about what is going on, and they're like, what has happened to my, you know, well, he was such a great family man, that would have been an interesting dynamic.
For sure.
Introduced. I don't know. And maybe they did in the sequels. I have not seen them.
Yeah, and the unstoppable nature of him, like, they're doing a vice run where the two of them are looking around to try and, I guess they're checking out the seedy underbelly of what's supposed to be New York to try and get information from some of his victims. And they're, at one point, there's a hooker outside a bar, and it looked really like it was Los Angeles. And I actually Googled the address of this place, and it, to this day, is a strip club. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I forget the name of it, but it's in North Hollywood. And I thought, that's when the movie went off the rails from a New York City to L.A. standpoint. But they did really capture the urban grit, regardless of which urban setting it was. And it's funny and ironic that Maniac, the original, would decamp and go off to L.A., because this movie is obviously part New York, part L.A., and the Maniac remake, which we might talk about as well, moved to L.A. But again, there's something really interesting and sinister about urban environments that perhaps resonates more with us because we're both city-born and city-raised, and you can't pick what type of horror influences you, right? It picks you. I'm into medical horror because I'm a hypochondriac, and I'm into urban horror because I'm a city dweller. And not being a religious person, that other kind of horror doesn't really affect me as much. This is the kind of horror that affects me most. We've both been mugged. We both live in the city. I love urban horror. And if you had like a really sinister cop coming after you, or hell, just on my walk home from your place now, if someone were to just to like pull me over, although that's not really the expression you'd use, but you get involved in a situation with authority figures and you're under their control, as you found out, in the worst possible way, there's no recourse.
The moment,
whether you're Freddie Gray's or you're, you know, the like moment, these high-profile cases in the States, they have you.
Yep.
Or in the Maryland case, they throw you in the back of a paddy wagon, the guy breaks his back under mysterious circumstances, shall we say. You are at their mercy.
The moment that you're in their sights and they decide that they want you... Maybe do those rights.
The Miranda rights, and then
they slap those cuffs on you, dude. You are in. You're
in their control. And really, and the body cameras are a long time coming, because you know if you're an honest, upstanding, forthright person, you have nothing to worry about with your body camera. And of course, in the situation in Tulsa, Oklahoma, strangely, that was malfunctioning. Right, so they don't have the body cameras there. Funny how that works, but yeah, like. We don't want to cast aspersions if any of our listeners are in law enforcement, but some people we know from high school, and again, this is not all law enforcement.
Right,
there's lots of good people, but there's certain people you know from growing up who have an authoritative bent toward them, who gravitate towards this profession.
Well, yeah, and I'm just gonna say, I mean, before we, when we met earlier today and we just had our little discussion before we started, let's not get too far into the blue lives and the black lives.
Yeah, for sure.
But you kind of, when you're discussing a movie like Maniac Cop in 2016 in an election cycle, it's sort of hard not to It's sort of hard not to mention it. I will also say that it's one of the most. It's a job that I could never fathom. Every day, put on that badge and go out there and protect the citizens. And because some of them do actually protect the
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we
and
don't want to
do
be
a
unfair,
lot of good
like,
in their
yeah.
community. And, it's the thing is, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm quoting an expression now, the baddest bell rings loudest. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's all we hear about. We hear about the bad cops. We don't hear about all the good cops and the good stuff they do in the communities because it doesn't sell newspapers. It doesn't pop a rating.
Yeah.
So, let's not get too down on
Let's just say that a healthy skepticism of authority figures is good for the population at large.
And but I'm gonna end that discussion about cops by saying I don't ever want to encounter a cop in any capacity, whether it's a negative capacity where I'm being arrested or worse, or in a capacity they're protecting me, because that means that I'm being the victim of a crime. As much as I love cops, I just don't want to have anything to do with cops.
Yeah, exactly.
Either way, it's bad news. So
that's
So I gave this movie 3.25. You're giving it...
Yeah, 3. It's definitely worth checking out. It's got a lot of visual style. It's pretty well written. The cast is just off the charts. Awesome. Tom Atkins is great and a favorite of one of our returning guests here on the show, Scott Drebbit from Daily Dead.
And he's a favorite of mine, too.
Yeah, and it's definitely worth checking out. Now we get to our favorite part of the show, which is, what did we learn?
Mack Riddle was sent for his transgressions to Sing Sing. Now, I'm going to betray some of my ignorance, because up until yesterday, when I did a little Googling, I did not know that Sing Sing was a real prison.
Well, because the name sounds made up, but it's a variant on an Algonquin or Mohawk word, and then which we couldn't pronounce, we as in whatever white people, and it just became...
It became this sort of blanket term for prison.
Yeah, in a way that another New York facility did as well,
Rikers?
Right? Attica.
Oh, Attica.
Attica, it's like Attica, Al Pacino yelling Attica, and you think, How did that come to be? But it's interesting. Yeah, Sing Sing sounds made up and almost innocuous.
It almost became...
It's like a theme park.
It became...
I could go to Sing Sing.
It became...
Sounds fun.
No, but it became idiomatic in the sense, he's being sent to Sing Sing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that it was idiomatic, so I actually Googled it.
Yeah.
The derivation of Sing Sing. In other words, how did they start calling prison Sing Sing? And then I found out that Sing, as much as I love New York City... And no, New York. I found out that Sing Sing is an actual maximum security located in upstate New York.
I did not know
that. So that's what I learned. That Sing Sing is an actual facility that existed and still exists to this day. Who would have thought?
Yeah, for sure. And what I learned is that anything that just showcases New York City is just so wonderful. Like Bleecker Street, 11th Avenue. There's a bar I really like.
The New York Times, the Daily News.
Oh,
New York State of Mind.
Yeah. There's a bar like just a few blocks north of Bleecker on 14th. It's called the Beauty Bar. And this is an aside, but it's a former beauty salon that they turned into a bar. So you can actually, while you're enjoying your cocktail, your beverage of choice, you can sit under a hairdryer. And it's just hilarious. Like, this speaks to the kind of ingenuity and interest that New York bars always tend to have. And also, as another aside, a friend of mine left several $100 worth of Toronto library books in this bar that we had to get the next day before we left, because it was a kind of a rowdy night, and he had them in his bag, and he took some out to show me. And we left them in this bar, and we left at 4 in the morning, and he would have been on the hook for hundreds of dollars of... This is a strange story. Like, who brings a bunch of library books to a bar, especially in a different city? We do. That's the answer.
This is Noel.
Yeah, this is Noel. Yeah. And I just thought, oh my God, we're going to be out. But this is just great. East Village, West Village, so full of really interesting places.
So were the books returned to you? Did you actually...
We had to go with minutes to spare to before our bus left from the Port Authority to get there, because bars don't open in the morning, right? Like, these places are open till 4 a.m. And I think they were open at around, I think, noon, and our bus was leaving at like 1, and we had to get out there and, it was a tight squeeze to get all that stuff there. Again, nice to see at the bottom line what I've learned is great to see New York in all its glory. We get to see a St. Patrick's Day parade, which prominently features members of the NYPD and the New York City firefighters, because Irish Americans are so deeply entrenched in the New York City first responders scene that this was, I guess, they had their permits for this before they got, they ran out, and they had some really neat shots of all this New York stuff before they had to decamp and go elsewhere. So that was a really cool thing to see. You gotta love that.
And I was gonna say, there's a reason why UNOL wrote a book entitled The Man Who Scared the Shark's Death and Other Tales of Drunken Debauchery.
Yeah, true tales of drunken debauchery. Yeah, we got up to a lot of debauchery that night. Yeah.
And Noelle and myself got up to a few tales of debauchery. But that's another podcast.
Yeah, for sure.
Discussion altogether. So, for more?
Yeah, check out reallyawfulmovies.com. And speaking of books, be sure and check out our excellent...
Don't check it out, buy it.
Oh, buy it, yeah. our book that's all about our favorite horror kills, Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons. You can pick that up at Amazon. And it's gotten really good reviews from the likes of Scream Magazine, Rumor, Shock Till You Drop, everyone. So check that out and follow us on Twitter, awful_movies. And for sure, send us your suggestions on movies we should be podcasting. Really awful movies at gmail.com, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.